following podcast is for informational purposes only. The contents of this podcast do not constitute tax, legal, or investment advice. Take responsibility for your own decisions, consult with the proper professionals, and do your own research.
I'm happy to report that the graph's always been very stable, which gives me excitement about the future because, like, I think, like, the graph's doing, like, really interesting, like, public goods for the world.
TIQ podcast. Today I'm speaking with Meher Roy, CTO and co-founder at Chorus One and show host at Epicenter TV. The opportunity to meet and interview Meher was an incredible honor, and as you're about to hear, he's one of the most thoughtful and insightful people ever featured on this podcast. Whether for his work on Epicenter or on the amazing growth of Chorus One, Meher is justifiably recognized as a true thought leader in the industry. And during this interview, we explore Meher's early education and career and his journey into crypto, along with the origins of Chorus One and Epicenter. Throughout the conversation, Meher gives his perspective on a variety of topics, including things like his thoughts on the future of validators, his experience working with vaccines, his interesting takes on technology, applying the Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger lens to the crypto industry, his vision for the future of the industry, and his experience as a validator supporting the graph. And I'm also very touched and humbled that Meher would open up and talk a little bit about his leukemia diagnosis in 2021 and how that experience influenced his life. As always, I start our conversation by asking about Meher's educational background.
Yeah, hi, Nick. Thank you for having me on the podcast. Yeah, educational background, biotechnology. I did bachelor's and master's in it. 6 or 7 years in the vaccines industry. So I have actual industrial experience related to biotechnology. And then I switched into crypto and learned the software engineering I know from practical experience. That's my educational background. Read lots of stuff in parallel. So
if we go back in time and think about your early interest in biotechnology and bioengineering, what drew your interest in those fields early on?
I came to the radical insight that our technology is pretty shit. And why do I say that? Because you might imagine, like, okay, why did Orville and Wilbur Wright build the plane? They built the plane because they could see that birds can fly. So I'm going to tell you, like, another thought experiment about what should be possible with technology. I want you to imagine kind of like a dinosaur or a snake for a moment. So both dinosaurs and snakes today and birds today, they lay eggs. If you think of what an egg is, imagine a bird egg or a snake egg. There is actually just information and very little material inside the egg itself. Eggs can be really small. That information, mostly information, is used to build like an embryo and then kind of like a chick or a tiny snake. Egg hatches. This snake goes into the world, collects resources autonomously, builds the body of that animal further. And then one day later, you might have a huge reptile out of it. The most interesting is, like, if you think of the dinosaur, like the Argentinosaurus or Brontosaurus, their eggs were actually pretty small. They were not much bigger than ostrich eggs. And then the ultimate animal would be 80 tons, like 80,000 kilograms. Many wings, the same as a modern aircraft. So if you imagine the human technological equivalent of that capability, what is that? It's almost like in the future, in the far human future, I should be able to have a stone in my hand, completely man-made stone, mostly consisting of some form of information. I throw that stone in the wild, and a few years later, it comes to me, a fully built car. That should be the human technological equivalent. And yet, like, you can see that we are way short of that goal. So sometimes we tend to think ourselves as like advanced creatures, and in some way we have this perspective that they are very advanced compared to nature, compared to biology, but it's just false. Like we're living in the stone age of technology, barely made few things work. There's a huge amount to go. And actually, like, to me, that's kind of like the attraction of biology.
You mentioned that in your teenage years, you were thinking about technology, and I'm sure some of the things you just mentioned there. What were you like as a kid? I mean, when you weren't thinking about these things, what were some of the hobbies and other interests you had?
I don't remember my childhood too much. As a child, I think I've kind of like always struggled with the social connection, like making a lot of friends. And even as an adult, I'm somebody who doesn't seek a lot of social connection, social validation. I've actually forgotten most of my childhood, but it was certainly like a childhood spent reading a lot of books. I had the privilege of coming from a relatively wealthy background, having a lot of time on my hands, never needing to do any household work, household chores or anything like that. That's pretty much it. So I made a conscious decision at some point in my life that, oh, I have to be socially more active. And then there was a phase in my life when I did that and I realized, yes, I could do it. And then I went back to probably to more of my older personality, which is like, yes, I can do it, but I don't care about it that much. So I tested the boundaries and then I probably recursed back into more of my original personality.
So if we go back to your university days, then you're studying biotech, getting degrees in bioengineering. At this point in your life, how are you envisioning your career? When you fast forward in your mind, what are you envisioning doing professionally?
I mean, all my immediate decisions were kind of based on what was available. The best of it was either work in finance, like investment banking, or work in industry related to biotechnology. And I was lucky to get a job that made me travel different places in the world, see various things on the industrial side. And I did that. And most of it was driven by lack of confidence, I guess, and the need to make money. When I look at someone like Vitalik, who's like doing interesting things at age 18, I just didn't have any of that confidence at age 18, not even at age 25. And so all of my early decisions were based on taking the option that's obviously there in front of me, which is to work in the vaccines industry.
So you're referencing there your time at Novartis. I think you spent almost 5 years working there on vaccines and diagnostics. Talk about your time there, some of the things you were working on, and what you learned as a result of working at Novartis.
Yeah, so I think I spent 7 years there. Yeah, I've done different things in the vaccine space ultimately. The vaccine industry is like a very small industry. It's an industry that has a range of products with different technologies. There are technologies that are operational today that were invented 100 years ago. Those vaccines work in one way. Then there are vaccines that are for later lineage, maybe 50 years ago or 60 years ago. And then there you have like kind of like the hypermodern vaccines. Maybe all vaccines fall under biotechnology, but the hypermodern start to fall under protein synthesis, protein matter as a recombinant DNA technology, all of these ultra cutting edge practices. And so what tends to happen because of this huge spread of technological range, you start to have manufacturing plants that look different from each other, like a manufacturing plant that's from the early 1900s, it may be even operational today, looks different from something we have built 5 or 10 years ago. And so a lot of my early part of this career was to go to these different plants and kind of like learn the basics of how kind of like the engineering and the supply chain of vaccines work, because specifically the company was training me in kind of like this cross-site knowledge of how engineering and manufacturing is done. So yeah, I spent a lot of time learning all that. And yeah, in parallel, I was also kind of like reading technological work essentially in various different areas. And then it's while doing that I kind of like found crypto. And I think the main thing that attracted to me about crypto was I felt that it's a technology that could thrive very easily as opposed to other technologies I was studying.
when you think back at your time at Novartis, how does that inform your perspective or opinion on the recent pandemic and the rollout of those vaccines? I don't know what it was like where you were living, but in the United States, there was a lot of vaccine hesitancy. How is your opinion on those types of things shaped by your experience at Novartis?
Working in the vaccines industry, of course, you end up sharing the viewpoints and ideologies of the industry you work in. I think that's true for crypto people too. So I was never a vaccines denier or, you know, like that kind of personality. I always thought like vaccines are a cool and nice technology. When the pandemic hit, I knew somewhat the other vaccine would be out. So when the pandemic hit, we could have built the vaccine. We could have tried to build it using sort of like recombinant DNA, protein-based technology, the kind that I was working in. That happened. There's actually like a few companies that did make vaccines using that older tech stack. But what happened in the pandemic was a completely new tech stack emerged, which is this mRNA tech stack. If you look at like kind of the properties of it, the mRNA vaccine tech stack is like revolutionary, right? In the crypto industry, we often value a technology based on accessibility. And the interesting thing about this mRNA technology is it is fundamentally a tech stack where it could get so economical that you could be manufacturing mRNA vaccines on really small scales, meaning like you could have like machines that are sitting in some small lab near you that are churning out machines. So it's a really powerful tech stack. What happened in COVID was you had the vaccine come from this tech stack, and then it was immediately given like clearance. It was maybe somewhat forcibly put into the bodies of millions of people. I think many people didn't want that to be forcibly done. I think the government did make a policy mistake in doing that. And then the other thing was, because it was coming in from this new tech stack, and then it was suddenly distributed to hundreds of millions of people, it turned out there were certain kinds of side effects inherent to that tech stack. Now, that tech stack can solve those side effects over time. And had the growth been more gentle for that tech stack, you know, you started with 100,000, 200,000 next year, I think a lot of the safety issues would have been addressed. But what happened is you put that new tech stack in hundreds of millions of people. And in that range, even if like kind of your side effects are happening at very low rates, maybe 1 in 1,000, but when you're putting it into 100 million people, it's certainly a lot of people that are having these side effects like myocarditis, where their hearts are getting inflamed. It's a really cool and really powerful technology. And I can kind of like get into why that is true. I think the COVID vaccine as such, it has a reason to exist and its cost-benefit trade-off is good. The mistake that was made, which is kind of like a policy mistake on a big level, is to actually force it down to hundreds of millions of people so early. I wish that wasn't done, but there's also like a silver lining to it being done, which is it has given this enormous thrust into mRNA vaccines technology. Actually, it can be a big deal for humanity in the long run.
After your time at Novartis, you made a move and worked on supply chain at GSK. You were there for, I think, about 2 years. What can you tell us about that experience?
So actually, that was not very different from the Novartis experience, because basically Novartis sold a big part of itself to GSK, and I just moved with that part. And it was a new name, but the same thing, which is why I tend to think of it as just like one job, one mega 7-year job. Maybe like a little bit that was different about GSK was it was already like experimenting with this mRNA vaccines technology. I was not working with those R&D experiments, but some of my friends and colleagues were working with that. So I kind of had exposure to this mRNA technology a few years before COVID, and I was kind of like already excited about it. But otherwise, there wasn't a huge gap.
What did your time working in this industry, biomedicine, vaccines, what did it teach you about business or technology?
One of the big takeaways I had, and benefit of hindsight, I think it's the correct takeaway, is healthcare and biotechnology moves really slow. And it fundamentally moves slow because it has to make difference for humans, and humans as a group are like risk averse. What that means is, if you, for example, look at how many new medicines are approved every year? It's 40. So you have all of the professors, PhD students, all of these companies, all of the people working. And all we produce are like 40 new medicines in a year. And many of them are small innovations on something that existed. Like a statin exists, cholesterol-lowering drug exists, atorvastatin exists, and somebody will build rosuvastatin, which is like a variant on the theme. And many of these 40 are kind of like variants on the theme. And it's only 40 per year. So if you imagine like 100 years, so it's like we're going to have 100 years later, at this rate, we're going to have 4,000 new medicines. The majority of them like copycats or replicates. So actually, I think like in 100 years, we might only be having like 200 or 250 generally new therapies. So what you can see is absent something fundamentally weird. Like many people have these dreams that, oh, medicine is going to like cure cancer and like we are on the doors of immortality and longevity, escape velocity. I'm very skeptical of that, that we are on the doors of longevity, escape velocity, because over 100 years, it's 250 or 200 genuine breakthroughs. Now, there are some odds that it could be that in those 200 breakthroughs, there are like four or five of them that are so massive that they can grant us immortality. It is possible that that can happen. I can tell you some of these candidate technologies that could be like that. But it is also possible that actually 100 years is not enough, which means we are all going to die. I could like see that thing structurally right there. And it was one of the main reasons I also wanted to do something in an area that would just evolve faster. One of my conclusions, strangely, is like bits over atoms. You see kind of like this conclusion. Many venture capitalists have that. They'll be like, I invest in SaaS. I don't touch hardware. Bits over atoms. And I also ended up having this bits over atoms conclusion that it's just much easier to manipulate bits. So sometimes I think manipulating bits can actually be much more impactful than manipulating atoms. People think, okay, manipulating bits easier than atoms, let me manipulate bits, but they feel like, oh, the world is not innovating in atom space, and like, okay, they're disappointed by it. But I actually think maybe it's just better to focus all our energy in manipulating bits well. And in fact, I actually think the way to immortality is by manipulating bits better and actually forgetting about fixing the body in the first place. So that's one of the main things I learned. Bits over atoms, manipulate bits rather than manipulate atoms. And also, you might just unlock bigger things by manipulating bits than by manipulating atoms.
That's a super interesting take. And so, as you mentioned earlier, it was during your time at Novartis that you started reading more about technology and became aware of crypto. Take us back in time. What were you reading and what were your first impressions or insights into crypto?
So we know Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger as like both of them as this huge critics of crypto. But strangely enough, it was them that threw me down the path of crypto. So in my teenage years, my father essentially gave me a gift, like all of the writings of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. He procured Charlie Munger's almanac from some place. It was quite difficult to get in India. And like he gave me those, and I kind of like I read on those books, and I had this interest in, of course, analysis of financial statements, right? Here's a company. How do you value a company? What is a company? You start to think what in those directions. And then you also see that sometimes Warren Buffett is like, they deal in derivatives. They deal in like, they'll write a huge options contract or something like that. And so I had kind of like exposure to these ideas. When I came across Bitcoin in 2011, I liked the idea. I love the idea because like in India, we have a very inflationary currency, and like, okay, the idea of deflationary money was sort of attractive. It was not attractive enough at that point to be building a career. So I followed that as a hobby for a few years. And my moment, like when I decided kind of, oh, I'm switching to crypto, is actually Vitalik Buterin, I think Bitcoin Miami, January 2014, unveiled the question of the concept of smart contracts. And my thought was, oh, smart contracts. Contracts means like derivatives contracts means corporations are built on top of this contracts. And I was like, oh, smart contracts are too fundamental. And then I think in a couple of days, I was like, okay, I'm making a career here. Because I was already thinking, manipulate bits, not atoms. Now it's like the question of what bits you're manipulating. And you're going to be manipulating contracts. Those are attractive types of bits to be manipulating. So it felt like as a no-brainer back in 2014. Yeah.
The GRTIQ podcast is made possible by a generous grant from the Graph Foundation. The Graph Grants program provides support for protocol infrastructure, tooling, dApps, subgraphs, and community building efforts. Learn more at thegraph.foundation. That's thegraph.foundation.
Hi, this is GRTIQ, and thank you for listening. Listeners who enjoy this content can help support the GRTIQ podcast by leaving a review or a 5-star rating wherever they download podcasts, by sharing episodes on social media, or by simply telling a friend or colleague about something they heard or learned from one of our guests. It's support from listeners like you that make it possible for us to keep shining a light on the people and stories behind Web3 and the Graph.
Roger that.
A lot of people love and respect the writings and work of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. Definitely very smart, capable people. And in terms of TradFi, maybe the most successful investors of all time. How do you reconcile the fact that these two figureheads, these two thought leaders, are so critical of something like crypto, and yet you chose to pursue a career in it?
So I think the teachings of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger are not irrelevant to crypto. And I actually tend to think it is actually crypto that has to learn their teachings, not the other way around. The key cornerstone of their teachings is that the value of an asset is essentially the value of the cash it can produce for you now and in the future. Cash that it produces that you can use at your own discretion. They call it owner's discretionary capital, is the accounting term they use. And there are crypto assets, Ethereum being the most prominent example, that produce ownery discretionary capital. So if you own, I own some Ether, they stake these Ether, and like staking returns are somewhere around 3.5% or 4%. The interesting thing about Ether is the supply of Ether no longer inflates that much. It hovers around 120 million. Some days it goes up, some days down, but generally it's like a flat line at around 120 million. With a fixed supply, when you stake Ether, you get like that 3.5% or 4.5%. Now, that 3.5% is what I call, in Warren Buffett's language, that is the owner's discretionary capital. I don't need to hold those Ether in order to preserve my ownership in the network, right? Like if I sell all my staking rewards, my ownership in the Ethereum network will remain exactly the same because the supply of Ether is flat, around 120 million. So that those staking rewards that are produced, that is owner's discretionary capital that I can do whatever I want with. This is different from something like Atom when you have staking rewards on other networks like Atoms or Kawa or any of these others. Those are highly inferior to the staking rewards of Ethereum because there the underlying coins are inflating as well. Though that is not genuine owner's discretionary capital. But Ethereum produces genuine owner's discretionary capital. And Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger's teachings are completely consistent with and applicable to valuing Ethereum as a network. So I think like that's the first thing. So I think there are parts of crypto where their teachings like fit perfectly. Now there are parts of crypto to which their teachings don't map. So a major part where teachings don't map is like Bitcoin, but their teachings will also not map very well to the NFT space and to the meme coin space. And my honest opinion of it is most of these art NFTs are useless. Most of the meme coins are useless. Bitcoin is where I feel tension. I feel genuine tension between their worldview and reality. And in reality, Bitcoin has become very valuable. People value it. I actually personally don't see the value in it. In my conceptual framework, it doesn't make sense. I go by the Buffett and Munger framework. But the world does value it, and it is providing me a contradictory signal to my framework, which means the framework should be broken in some way. So I do accept that it could be broken in some big way. So kind of like that's where I am. When I look at Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger themselves, I think what's happened with them is cryptocurrency has landed at a time point when they were both past 90 years old. Had they been 30 years old or 40 years old, I am sure they would have been investing in parts of the cryptocurrency space because it is very consistent with their worldview. And it's just down to age. So I just think like that, right? Yeah.
So you mentioned that in January 2014, something that Vitalik said in introducing smart contracts in Miami sparked sort of a pivot point for you in terms of career and how you were thinking about what you were going to do. In 2015, you joined Epicenter TV. That's a podcast that gets referenced on this podcast all the time. What's the backstory there? How did you go from getting interested via something Vitalik said to going to work and contributing on Epicenter?
I decided I want to make a career in crypto in the early 2014, but I didn't know any software engineering. I could not build a code base. Many of listeners will have faced this problem. Like when you don't know software engineering, it's really hard to break into crypto. And there did not used to be all of these research analyst jobs back then that are there today, like Messali and the company have good programs there. So I think my central challenge is like, how do you even break into something like cryptocurrency? And the other problem I had, and I still do, is I'm not based in like Silicon Valley or New York. I'm based in Basel, which is like a small town. The first thing I tried to do was I tried to organize a local meetup in Basel. Truth is, I did a good job at that meetup. Like we had really interesting talks, really interesting guests and all. But there was a point where the first meetup, 30 people attended, and then by the 10th meetup, it was down to 3 people. I was inviting all the interesting guests, but it's just, you're in Basel, so you're going to get like 3 or 4 people. So when the opportunity to be on Epicenter came up, I think my biggest motivation was I get to talk to interesting people and I don't need to move out of Basel. That's the really powerful thing about a podcast from the host side. And I have personally never cared about views. I don't even like see the Epicenter episodes myself much. I may not have seen it for the last several years, right? So for me, it's more about like learning and connecting with interesting people rather than the views or anything that you could derive from it. And it helped me break into crypto because I think with Epicenter, what happened was I started doing it and some people realized that while I may not be a software engineer, I am somebody that can think like an engineer for sure. And I can talk engineering for sure. That's kind of the confidence I needed to be actually now then building Chorus where I am doing engineering the day in, day out.
As a host at Epicenter, you have a reputation for being able to explain technical or complicated things in a way that's easy to understand. Is that something you do deliberately or is that just kind of a natural ability you have when you explore these things?
It tends to come easily to me. Maybe I have been like that for a while. I also see it with my child. Like I'm able to teach my child really advanced things at age 5. It's something that's intrinsically been there, but it turned out that way in Epicenter. And yeah, sometimes I've kind of like wondered whether I could take that to higher level, you know, like in theory, I could try to build something like a Lex Friedman show or something like that. But then, yeah, never gone down that path.
As a result of doing so many interviews, meeting so many thought leaders and exploring a really vast amount of ideas in Web3, because of your work on Epicenter, have you developed some unique perspectives or things that over time you've come to learn, hey, I think about this differently than a lot of people? What are those?
So I think like the biggest thing is that I actually subscribe to the Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett school. And I think like cryptocurrency networks, some of them can be valued like rationally in terms of like cash flow they produce. And I believe that it should be the objective of entrepreneurs to be, when they're building their crypto token or crypto network, to be building products that people pay to use and they have cash flow. And actually, when I look at the majority of entrepreneurs, they are not in that mode. For example, I don't think liquidity mining or airdrops are such a great idea, right? Because ultimately, in an airdrop, you're diluting equity. Like if you do an ICO, like an ICO is a great idea. You're diluting equity in your network, and in exchange, you get capital, which can fund the development of that. That's an amazing idea. But an airdrop is more akin to you're giving away equity in your network in exchange to get marketing. But marketing is only valuable when your network has a good product. And many of these things is don't have good products. So you're paying for marketing, but that marketing is not applied at the right point in the life cycle of a network. Like, for example, like if DYDX does airdrops, it makes sense. DYDX network has an amazing product. Okay, some airdrops to develop marketing for DYDX makes sense. It's interesting that DYDX has never had much return on its marketing. Like its marketing has been consistently poor despite the airdrops. So maybe there are cases where like, okay, the airdrop makes sense, makes like national economic sense. The majority of cases, I find like the airdrops being ultimately really stupid ideas. There's something that is also true for like liquidity mining. Sometimes liquidity mining can make sense. It can make sense when liquidity is the central constraint in improving your product. There are genuinely things that have that nature. But you see liquidity mining applied indiscriminately because that's the way to get kind of like attention. That's the way to get community. That's the way to get buzz. That buzz translates into prices. Reason it translates into prices is nobody's actually valuing these coins rationally in a Buffett and Munger manner. So that kind of like behavior persists. But in the end, I believe that behavior is going to be negative for humanity. Right? Like that behavior is not going to be positive. Those are kind of like perspectives that are different. They may not stem from like interviewing loads of people, but rather I believe that you should have crypto networks that have coins. Those crypto networks ought to have some product. And that product has to be that good that people are willing to pay for that product. And in that sense, the constraints on a crypto network are no different from the constraints on a corporation. Another thing I believe is many people tend to think of crypto as solving the problems of open source funding. You're going to see that again and again. And I just think it's wrong. The crypto networks that will last 100 years, they'll be those that are fundamentally have a good product that people are willing to pay for. If there's an open source project that doesn't have that characteristics, doesn't have a defensible product for the long run, slapping a crypto token on it cannot save that open source project. So, for example, if you're building, I don't know, distributed Git, and then it's combined with a coin, I doubt it's going to work in the long, long run. It will work in the short term. The prices will go up. Some people will dump it, make a fortune off it. It's not going to be like kind of a self-sustaining fire that lasts a long, long time.
So if we return to your personal story and the things you're working on, you pivot into crypto, you launch and start working on Epicenter. And then in 2017, you co-found and launch Chorus One. Take us back in time there. What were you working on and why did you choose entry into industry as a validator?
So it was not some hugely pre-calculated decision. So I had made enough money just holding Bitcoin and ETH that I could take a few months off. And I did that. And then I was just going to conferences and like reading books and stuff like that. And Brian, my co-founder, was working for Cosmos Network. Like Cosmos wasn't launched yet. he was working for the company, which was called All In Bits, that was going to launch that network. And he was like, okay, for that network, we need validators. He had these atoms and he wanted some place to stake them. And there were not a lot of validator companies around. So kind of he was like, okay, wants to build a validator. And I was like, okay, I'll try that engineering challenge. And kind of like, that's where I got started. I actually did not think Chorus would become as big as it has. Historically, I've been skeptical of the validator business model. I always thought it's not such a great business model. What's kind of turned out is that the business model is not so good, but the market's just huge. And so the size of the market somehow compensates for a bad business model. And you end up still having firms that are like huge, like 50 people, 70 people, 300 people, 500 people, like working all their lives in staking. And that's how kind of like I also ended up having one of these firms. I still find myself complaining about the business model. But yeah, it's the size of the market that compensates for it.
That's an amazing take. What's your perspective on the future of validators then? If you're a little suspicious of the business model, but maybe market size compensates, what does that say about the future?
So I think like the future is also kind of like you can sketch out the future pretty easily, I think here. So the validators, but also like blockchain infrastructure in general. So the difference, what is the difference between those two terms? You can have validators, but then some networks might need an indexer like the Graph, or Chainlink might need an Oracle. So not validators necessarily. Bridges need something different. That's also not a validator really. And so when you start building validators, you realize, okay, I could be building watchtowers, I could be building oracles, and you do all of these things, and then you realize, oh, I need a tower just beyond validator, and then start to think yourself as blockchain infrastructure, right? But ultimately, what is it? You're running like some kind of server securely, it's running some kind of software, and then usually like the pricing is really competitive. I think that's another feature of it, because there are many people in the world that can do it. Now, the interesting thing about this industry is because of the demand side, lots of crypto holders want decentralization. On the supply side, what that means is that the supply of it has to be fragmented. For example, if the validation industry were like web search, where Google owns 30% of the market, none of these chains would be decentralized. So the only way the demand for decentralization can be filled is if for every network there's like 40 or 50 different firms willing to show up and run whatever infrastructure they want to run. In web search, when the market clears, there is no consideration for decentralization. Like the user's decision of what search engine to use doesn't have decentralization as a metric worth optimizing for. But in this industry, the user has decentralization as a metric worth optimizing for. And so what that means is on the supply side, this industry is going to be fragmented. You're going to have, in the end, of course, power laws will exist, right? Like the biggest validator will be very large. They might be having like 10% of the stake across like some large some networks, and then the second one will be 6 or 7%. But then there's going to be like this kind of like long tail where actually maybe 50 or 100 or maybe even 500 firms exist and they can make a living off it. And it has to be that way for the desire for decentralization to be serviceable. So if the market does not clear like that, we're going to have centralization. So I think the desire for decentralization creates like a fragmented market, and it has to be that way. Now, the market is fragmented because of that, but also another feature of blockchain infrastructure broadly is blockchain infrastructure needs to be made generic. So if you're launching a new network, like Graph is having an indexer, you don't want one indexer to be like so good that they can be 5x better than the other. If that's true, you probably want to open source the software and make all of the indexes be kind of roughly equal in terms of their capabilities. So if kind of like this blockchain infrastructure is kind of like roughly equal, then it also means that the underlying product is a commodity. Like as an end user, when you're choosing validators, your choice of A or B, there cannot be like a massive gap in their capabilities. There will of course be some gap, but there cannot be a massive gap. And so it looks more like a commodity where if you extract oil, a barrel of oil from Canada is not the same as a barrel of oil from Saudi Arabia. It's not the same as a barrel of oil from Venezuela. There are chemical differences that can be measured. There are energy extraction differences that can be measured. But yet we tend to think of it if up there as like a unified commodity, oil. And I think like the kind of like staking, like validation and blockchain infrastructure also has that nature. Like different providers are different, but there is also some like actually underlying, broad underlying similarity in their offers. And because it's a commodity, it's going to be like a highly competitive market, fragmented market. And you're going to have like, I don't know, 50 or 100 firms or maybe even 500 firms that make a living off it. Now, the interesting thing is the total market size may be massive. So today, I think the total staked assets across all networks may be in the, I think they are above 500 billion. They might be even the something 500 billion for sure. And it could be that kind of like, in the long future, it could still grow 10x from years. It could be 5 trillion market or like even 50 trillion market. Who knows? Maybe 5 trillion is more practical. So when you have like 5 trillion, and then if you split it across 100 firms, of course, they will not split evenly. Then it turns out like if you do the math, 5 trillion divided by 100 is like 0.5 trillion, 0.05, 50 billion AUM per average firm. If 50 firms survive, but even if you have like 10 billion AUM across 250 firms on average, it's 10 billion AUM. Many of these are kind of like vibrant workplaces with decent sized teams, with decent expertise, etc. So that's kind of where I think validation will end, which is that if you think in a Peter Thiel sense, like Peter Thiel always talks about entrepreneurs should be building monopolies, right? In a Peter Thiel sense, validation is simply not a market Peter Thiel would look at because underlying product is a commodity. Market is very competitive. Yet in a quality of life sense, for the founders and the team members, validation provides a clean way to make a living. For example, there are many industries like the arms industry where you're dealing with unsavory people. That's not true of validation, right? Like, you're doing interesting things for the world. You necessarily don't have a regulatory troubles, at least today. We may change in the future, or legal troubles today. So you're not necessarily even having a huge environmental footprint. And I mean, in Chorus, we have also tried to remove some of the consequences of running these servers. It's a clean, good, morally feeling right, upright way of making a living. And there's demand for it in the world, and there is the opportunity for it for thousands of people to be making their living this way, providing decentralization fundamentally as the end product. It's a good place. It's not Peter Thiel's perfect market to build a unicorn startup, maybe. But it's still a thing worth doing.
You mentioned that Chorus works as an indexer at the Graph. As you may know, a lot of my listeners are very enthusiastic about the Graph. Do you have any hot takes on the Graph or any kind of insights to share about your experience working as an indexer on the network?
So it's been a great experience, actually. The indexer infrastructure like runs very stably. I get to know when networks are not stable. And I'm happy to report that the Graph's always been very stable, which gives me excitement about the future because like I think like the Graph's doing like really interesting like public goods for the world. My concern over the graph has been like, how does this business model work in a Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger sense? I've never kind of like understood it really well from that angle. But the service that it itself offers, I see the product as being value. Because I see the product being replicated again and again by many companies, right? Like they're building these indexes in-house. I think the product's good, the network's really stable. I have wondered how good the business model of the graph is, but that's fine, right? Like the graph is still young in its journey. Right? It's been around about since what? Like I think I meant Yaniv in 2018. The graph is not that old, actually. Right? It's just maybe 5 years. So there's still time for a business world, good business world. When I look at Yaniv's recent tweets, he talks about these knowledge graphs being something that this network is going to go down that path. And I tend to think like that could be something where its product will end up becoming more differentiated. I think one of the things is when you're indexing a blockchain graph and you are taking a set of public data and then you're transforming it into another public data, and much of it is like logic that is automated and easily duplicable, the business model is going to be harder. But when you start to talk something like knowledge graphs, I have a feeling that these knowledge graphs are going to be not so easy duplicable. And it's going to lay the foundation for a better business model in the future. And fundamentally, like this network has the engineering chops to be able to do interesting things. Yeah.
So Meher, you're at a point in your life, if we return to your life story, where it's full steam ahead. You've got Epicenter, wildly successful. You're working on Chorus One, which was more successful than you even anticipated and is growing. And then in early 2021, you go in for a routine checkup and get a cancer diagnosis. Can you take us back to that experience? What happened?
I was having this kind of like these weird symptoms where my heart rate was like quite elevated parts of the day. There was a time when like I went jogging and I fell down on the road. So it's hard to get back home. And then there were like sometimes like headaches and things like that. And that's why I went for the checkup and it turned out to be leukemia. So, and yeah, leukemia is essentially a type of like liquid cancer. It's like some cell that is in your blood, basically gone berserk and replicating. It's kind of hard. It's a difficult disease because blood goes everywhere. So it's systemic. It's not localized. And then therapy is also systemic. Systemic therapies are harder than localized therapy. So if your tumor is cut out, sometimes it can be an easier therapy. You might not even lose your hair or anything like that. But yeah, it's a systemic thing. It's kind of like harder. So I basically went somewhere for a checkup. Initially, the doctor was like, this is nothing. She took my sample. Next day, I receive a call. And in the call, the doctor says, brain clots. It's going to be a journey. So I went to the clinic. She gives me the diagnosis. And then half an hour later, I'm admitted in the hospital. 9 months in the hospital. This was COVID time, so my son can't visit. My wife can visit for half an hour a day. I'm there like 9 months, taking like different infusions, losing 20 kilos weight, losing all my hair. A genuinely intense experience. And then get out of that, and then therapy continues, but from home for 2 more years. And then now I'm done with the therapy, and I'm past it with 85% odds. And 15% odds it returns. And if it returns, the day I was diagnosed, the odds of survival were only 40%. So I have climbed from 40 to 85 now. And now, but 15% it returns. And if it returns, my survival odds are probably going to be down to 20 or something like that. It's going to be hard. And maybe that's not a resignable moment yet, but maybe it's getting close to a resignable moment already. You can resign and have fun.
Meher, you're clearly a brilliant person who thinks deeply about things, forms opinions and judgments that are sound and rational. So take us inside your mind. How does someone with your mental architecture process the news that when everything seems to be going so well, you've got this diagnosis of leukemia?
What's quite weird is I did not feel immediately scared when I got the diagnosis. I was actually like, it's fine. It's a new thing to play with. And actually, initially, they were dosing me with this one drug that makes you feel superhuman, like genuinely, right? Like you feel superhuman. And like the first 10 days, I went through like, yeah, feeling like superhuman. It's called prednisone. And then it took me like many months to be like, maybe like going through like depression. And then, yeah, my 8 or 9 months in the hospital ended. And the strange thing is that I started gaining weight again and I started to have some more normal energy. The hardest point was actually like not the therapy, actually. Because in therapy, your body is being hammered by these drugs and like your mind doesn't have enough energy to think. It's when you recover and then your mind starts to think, then you start to be really scared. So the point is like, you know, the Led Zeppelin song, The pain of war cannot exceed the woe of aftermath. So the really hard part is the aftermath, when your intense therapy kind of like ends, you start being normal, and then you work through all the consequences of this. And then that's when kind of like depression happens. That's when PTSD happens. That's when like all hell breaks loose. I had like all of these like standard experiences through it. The human brain finds it hard to actually even conceive of non-existence. It is actually quite hard. The human brain also like recoils from non-existence. It creates stories to cover the pain of non-existence. And what kind of stories does it create? Like, come from India. Like, the Hindu story is, you're a soul and you're going to be reborn, right? So like death will be like shedding clothes and then you're going to be reborn as something else. And in a way, I think it's, you're responding to like the brain's need for, it's like you can see that you will die in non-existence, but like to cover non-existence, it creates this story to cover that non-existence because it is genuinely hard to conceive of it, ruminate on it. The Christian story is, you're going to die and then you're going to be judged. And actually, most people think they have lived their life well and they believe that they will be judged well. Because the bad deeds we do, we always figure out a way to spin it in a way that it was not so bad or I asked for forgiveness from the Lord. And end up thinking, no, actually, I'm right. I have led a good life. And then when people think of judgment day, they usually say, well, I'm going to be judged well, and I'm going to end up in a good place. And that's the Christian way of covering non-existence. It's a universal human attribute to find a story to cover non-existence. And so I have my own story. And my story is that we may already have the technology such that actually none of us actually need be mortal. And that technology is called cryonics. It's what Hal Finney did. So that's my story. It's also a story. It's no different from the Hindu story or the Christian story. It's just story. But I seek comfort in that story. And that's how I cover the fear of non-existence.
Well, Mehor, I know I echo the thoughts and sentiments of a lot of people that are listening to this interview and have been following your work for a very long time, that we're so happy that presently your health is well. And you've written a lot about this experience. I'll leave a note in the show notes where people can go read some really impactful Medium articles that you published about your experience. I only have one final question for you before I ask you the GRT IQ 10. These are 10 fun questions I ask each guest of the podcast every week to get to know you a little bit better. And the question is this: if you forecast out 5 to 10 years from now and think about the industry, What's different and what's the same?
What's the same? I tend to think like some of the fundamental successes that this industry has found will persist for the long run. So specifically, I believe like these, like, okay, these blockchains that host smart contracts will be there. And I believe these novel mechanisms for trading things, which includes a D&D order book, which includes an AMM, which includes cow swaps thing. I think these novel trading mechanisms and novel ways of kind of bundling things into portfolios, like Balancer does, I think those mechanisms, you know, like they're to stay and they will become big. And a lot of parties that issue assets and don't think of blockchains as options today will issue things on a blockchain. Maybe the Swiss government is going to be issuing bonds on the blockchain. Those parts of the industry, they're going to stay, they're going to consolidate, and they're going to broaden in distribution. What will be different is people will have changed. So I think a lot of like the early crypto person was maybe very politically motivated. They were like people with ideals, or try to do things. And I think in like 10 or 20 years, those people are going to get churned out, like not in a bad sense. They're going to make money and they're going to retire and be churned out that way. And they're going to be end up replaced by enterprise types or these Wall Street types of personality, which is going to end up like kind of like dominating kind of like the industry. And sometimes it's like, you know, the Who has this song, meet the new boss, the same as the old boss, right? Like, it will happen. So when we're saying like the new boss will be the same as the old boss, in what sense? It's like, you're going to have all of these personalities coming in from TradFi, Wall Street, and you're going to have blockchains that have KYC inbuilt in them, this built in them, that built. And they're going to be, for the early crypto people, they're going to throw up looking at like all of these designs that are going to come. And they'll be surprised at how successful some of these designs will end up being, because the powers that be, when they end up transacting on these blockchains, those blockchains are going to be successful. So meet the new boss. They look a little bit like the old boss. What's genuinely different about the new boss is the value of open source will live. Like the value of open source will live. The value of, okay, deploying an open source smart contract, the world attacking it, security getting tightened up, that's really powerful. Cryptography will live, meaning hundreds of millions of people in the world, they end up having public keys and private keys and knowing cryptography, which is like, what an amazing outcome on a 30 or 40 year scale. Smart contract blockchains, and even application-based chains, I think they live. These novel market mechanisms, it will turn out that the space of these novel market mechanisms is actually massive. Just like, you know, like the fractal nature of knowledge, right? So mathematics used to be something that maybe 100,000 people used to do in their spare time in the 1200s. It turns out it's so big. And then now you have some subset of mathematics. And if we would zoom into that, it would also turn out to be infinite, right? That's the nature of knowledge. And it would turn out that these incentive-based mechanisms, when you zoom into it, it's sort of like, you'll see that it's kind of like endless and there's many useful things out there. I think the disappointing part to many when we like, yeah, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. The good parts of it is like open source cryptography, economic incentive mechanisms. I think like those would be really powerful. The thing I don't know about the future is, will there be a distributed superintelligence? I think like that's the variable I don't know. That actually looks like the fundamental uncertainty to me, where the nature of artificial general intelligence, of course, there's going to be centralized artificial general intelligence, but will there be sort of a network that's kind of like generally intelligent, maybe like even like super intelligent. And its intelligence is not in a node, but it's in the coordination between many nodes. Like, will we build that structure? And like, if we build that structure, I think it's going to be very hard to control that thing. And if it's going to be very hard to control that thing, and it's going to be super intelligent, then what will its objective function be like? I think like that's the genuine uncertainty to me, because in a sense you have artificial general intelligence coming, but what the lessons of crypto is actually a lot of things, maybe many things, can be built in a censorship resistant, unshutdownable manner. Artificial general intelligence is coming, so could you have unshutdownable distributed artificial general intelligence? I think theoretically, yes. But if yes, then its objective function, who controls it? What does it do? It's not a trivial thing. So I think like that's kind of like the fundamental uncertainty about the future to me.
Well, Mehar, now we've reached a point where I'm going to ask you the GRTIQ 10. These are 10 questions I ask each guest of the podcast every week. It's kind of a lightning round that allows us to get to know you a little bit better personally. But also, I always hope these answers help listeners learn something new, try something different, or achieve more in their own life. So, Mehar, are you ready for the GRTIQ 10?
Sure.
The GRTIQ 10.
This is the way. 10 questions for astronauts floating in space.
What book or article has had the most impact on your life?
Kinematic Self-Replicating Machines, Ralph Merkle, and then Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger's books, yeah.
Is there a movie or a TV show that you recommend everybody should watch?
I think Three Body Problem from Netflix.
If you could only listen to one music album for the rest of your life, which one would you choose?
Mozart, like greatest hits of Mozart, or like Led Zeppelin, greatest hits. I think it would be those two, I guess.
What's the best advice someone's ever given to you?
My father, go west. Go west.
Mayor, what's one thing you've learned in your life that you don't think most other people know or have learned quite yet?
Cryonics is powerful. We may already be immortal if only we choose to accept it.
What's the best life hack you've discovered for yourself?
It's to be able to, in a situation, be able to think, if my life was very short, does this make sense? And on the other side, Titanic works and we are immortal. Does this make sense?
And then based on your own life experiences and observations, what's the one habit or characteristic that you think best explains how people find success in life?
I think success, the central thing to appreciate for success is the effect of compound interest, the compounding of work, where things always seem small in the day-to-day, but become grand in the fullness of time.
And then, Mehar, the final three questions are complete the sentence type questions. The first one is, the thing that most excites me about Web3 is?
Open source cryptography.
And how about this one? If you're on X or Twitter, then you should be following?
If you're on X or Twitter, you should be following Bev Jesus.
And then the final question, Mehar, I'm happiest when?
I'm happiest when I build something interesting. And that's something interesting.
The GRT IQ 10.
And I show you how deep the podcast.
Mehar Roy, thank you so much for joining the GRT IQ podcast. This has been an absolute joy for me to meet you. And as I said earlier, a lot of my listeners, including myself, are big fans of all the work you're doing and some of the thought leadership you've established. If people want to stay up to date with you and follow some of the things you're working on, what's the best way for them to stay in touch?
I actually don't blog a lot, unfortunately. Yeah, maybe just take with Chorus One, because like, my life's kind of like spent building the validators.
This has been a production of the GRTIQ podcast.
For more information, including detailed show notes, visit grtiq.com/podcast. That's grtiq.com/podcast.
Please consider contributing to this project and helping build the community by subscribing and leaving a review.
GRTIQ podcast.
Roger that.